One of the most fascinating parts of human life is the thing we call time. It doesn't exist in the way we know it, except for human beings who can conceive past and present and future, who can divide time and regulate their lives by it. Otherwise, as Thomas Mann once wrote, time has no divisions to mark its passing. There is never a thunderstorm to announce the beginning of a new month or year. Or, as our own Henry David Thoreau put it much more quaintly, time is but the stream I go a-fishing in. Whatever it is, it penetrates our lives and languages in so many ways that my unabridged dictionary, under its primary heading alone, lists 67 different meanings. I made the mistake once of asking students to write an in-class paper of definition of the word time. They threw up their hands in despair, and they were right, including the one who parodied a famous folk poem and began his final exam paper this way: "Backward, turn backward, O time, in your flight, and tell me just one thing I studied last night." We're not going to bog down this morning in theories of time which have influenced people, the circular, the linear, heaven knows what others. We're going to think about time in more practical ways, and one of them is how differently we experience one segment of time from another one that is quantitatively the same, so that time actually seems to slow down or speed up. I can give you a personal illustration. I am not, and this may be the understatement of the year, I am not a good shopper. I tend to enter a store only when I have a highly specific need, and if I can't find what I want quickly, it seems to me that days are passing and that all my energies are draining away like water through sand. I confess this with keen regret because it dawned on me a long time ago that the most valuable single gift a husband can have is one for shopping in a leisurely, graceful manner, making charming conversation as he moves from counter to counter, looking with interest, sincere or feigned, at first this item and then another. And I would say to you that mothers who want to shape their sons into ideal husbands should teach them early on in life to enjoy leisurely shopping, the kind with no definite aim except the delight of looking and pricing and making comparisons. It's a significant element in a happy marriage, and mine has had to do without it. I hear my wife say sometimes of other husbands in hushed and reverent tones, "He goes shopping with her." And I have spasms of regret and resolved to try it again, but it never works. 30 minutes in a department store drifting from rack to rack is an absolute eternity. Obviously, time is relative, because right after I explain that my feet are hurting and my legs are rubbery and my energy is failing, I can drive to a gym and walk and jog and lift weights for an hour and a half and think it's only a 20-minute outing. Time speeds up pleasantly when I mow a lawn or rake a garden. I thought of another illustration, but I happen to be looking directly at a beloved friend who is a dentist, and I'm going to omit that one for the morning. You know all these things, of course, already by personal experience. 1 hour drags, another one flies. Einstein weighed in on this problem and suggested one time this sort of relativity by saying that if a young man passionately in love spends an hour with his sweetheart, it'll seem to him like 5 minutes. But that if he sits on top of a red-hot stove for 5 minutes, it will seem like forever. All true, but not the aspect of time I want to pursue this morning. There is another, which I try to suggest by the title of the sermon, The Right Moment. The best text for it in the Bible probably is one of the Jewish proverbs, which I will read for you, not in the old 1611 King James Version. On second thought, I think I will do that because it's good for you to realize how much translations have improved. Here is the proverb in the 350-year-old English classic. As he that taketh away a garment in cold weather, and as vinegar upon nitre, so is he that singeth songs to a heavy heart. Now I think that is muffled in verbal wool, and the point does not come through sharply and pungently. But listen to this 1971 translation in the paraphrase called the Living Bible, where the point is as clear as words can make it. Being happy-go-lucky around a person whose heart is heavy is as bad as stealing his jacket in cold weather or rubbing salt into his wounds. The point is, we have to consider not only whether what we do is all right in itself, we also have to consider whether we have picked the right time to do it. Everything has its appointed hour, according to that famous third chapter of Ecclesiastes, part of which you heard Lindsay read a few minutes ago. There is a time to cry, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance, a time for silence, a time for speech, the matter of timing. Jesus understood it, and one day he said, I have yet many things to say to you, to his disciples, but you cannot bear them now. Not now, maybe later. I've read that and wondered what other things he might have said to them had they been capable of understanding. What other challenging truths might have come down to us in Scripture if they had been ready, but it would have been wasted then, whatever it was, and he knew it, so he held back, and we missed it. Shakespeare has Brutus make the same point very persuasively and beautifully in the tragedy of Julius Caesar. There is a tide in the affairs of men which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. Omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in miseries. Better poetry than psychology, I suppose, but accurate often enough to make sense. A large part of wisdom lies in knowing how to read the tide and act in concert with it. You all have your own horror stories of how bad it is when somebody chose the wrong moment. Billy lost a brother some years ago, and a minister was asked to speak who had known the family for many years. He consented and did a good job. He understood grief, and he gently recalled the happy hours and the good qualities in her brother Marion's life. But when he finished, and without an invitation, the local minister in the little Texas town where the service was being held stood up to tack on an official coda. Some of my worst experiences in public assemblies have come from speakers who can't let a good thing alone, who have to pop up again and repeat what a better speaker has already said, who have to tack on the coda. This man, knowing neither Marion nor the family, had no feeling for the occasion. It simply afforded him an opportunity to preach, and preach he did, telling sinners how to be saved, exhorting those around the grave to repent of their misdeeds and be in church every Sunday. It was an odious violation of the sanctity of grief, and it left a bitter taste in the mouths of all of us who were there. Perhaps by now some personal sorrow has taught that young man better, but on that day he chose the wrong moment. I was even more amazed once at a sermon delivered by a well-known minister at a large and lovely wedding in Oklahoma City. The groom was a handsome, clean-cut young man. The bride, a close friend of Billy's, was radiant in white, as dewily fresh as brides are supposed to be in even the most romantic imagination. So what was the preacher's wedding day homily? It was a 15-minute harangue on the evils of illicit sex. To this day, we have no idea what led him into such exquisitely awful timing. It was a moment for tenderness and trust, for optimism and hope, but the whole atmosphere in that church darkened, and this is true, the sun itself, in one of those rare instances of symbolic timing, actually ducked behind a cloud while he ranted on about sexual misdeeds and the degenerate morality of the nation's young. Now, I'll grant that those two remembered examples are rather spectacular, but they do serve to strengthen the biblical point. Timing is important. Anytime, anywhere, but especially in family relationships, because families are so close and so much together. One of the really good services people who live in the intimacy of a family can perform for each other is to help by calling attention to imperfections. But that kind of criticism, unless you want it to ruin everything, has to be carefully timed. I shudder a little at the recollection of how badly I have timed some of mine. The difference, someone has said, between a nagging wife and a gentle wife, and you must also read husband, is that the gentle person knows how to time the suggestion, or to put it crudely, the one person nags all the time while the other times his or her nags. And that's the crucial difference. If criticism is given gently at a time when we've done something fairly well, or we're feeling good, we can make room for it. The other guests who are sitting around our table of self-perception are such nice people that we can admit a critical stranger. But if you catch us when all the other rooms in our psyche are empty and desolate, when we're feeling low and foolishly inept, we'll probably call your criticism nagging and resent it with everything we've got. Time it differently, and we may be grateful the rest of our lives to someone who cared enough about us to tell us of a weakness. So, the right moment. It's part of what Paul had in mind when he said, make the best possible use of your time. I am kidded sometimes by a dear friend who hears these sermon tapes down in Dallas for being so obsessed with the value of a normal, ordinary day. And rightly so, I suppose, because I really do feel that way. I would like to live by Emerson's dictum, write it on your heart, that every day is the best day in the year. I don't always, but that's my ambition. The time to do the right thing, the good thing, is now. Not tomorrow, on a special day, but on this day, as holy as any day that is. And I think this applies in a special way to religion. We misread the Christian faith when we relegate religion to special hours and seasons. One of the brightest religious thinkers in modern times, in my book, was a former Archbishop of Canterbury by the name of William Temple. He used to say, God is not primarily interested in religion. Hoping, I suppose, it would shock enough people to make them ask what he meant. And what he meant was that the set hour for worship, the trappings of ritual, the special vocabulary we use, are all peripheral and not essential things. People who prepare for being religious only in those ways will miss all kinds of chances to meet life creatively and to worship God often. I hope very much that it will not be church people who complain most during what may be some dark and difficult times still ahead of us and our country. I hope that, because church people should be able to find grounds for optimism where perhaps some others cannot. It's an item of their faith that those who watch for the right moment and confront it creatively can make darkness the harbinger of a better day. I keep remembering an old inscription I read once. In the chapel of a little village in England called Stanton Harold, near the center of the country, in the year 1653, it says, when all things sacred were throughout the nation either demolished or profaned, Sir Robert Shirley, baronet, founded this church, a man whose singular praise it is to have done the best things in the worst times. I'd like to have known Sir Robert. a man not to be defeated by time nor by the times. I can't have that privilege, but there will always be others like him in education, in government, in religion, in this very church, people who have no time to weep over the inevitable, people who keep their heads up and their eyes open, watching for the right moment to do the right thing, because it always comes.